A lot of questions there, and I have a lot of answers
Don,
for you.
Don, always asking the real questions here. Yeah.
From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. This episode of Fragmented has been brought to you by Rollbar. With Rollbar, you can catch code errors before your users do, because I don't know about you, but the last place I want to find an error is inside of a one-star review on Google Play. That's just pretty much the worst-case scenario, because getting those one-star reviews to go away is really problematic. So the next best thing is actually preventing them from happening. So if we can prevent those errors, even better. Rollbar will help you do that. The cool thing about Rollbar is they work with all your existing major languages and frameworks. And to really tie this together is they work with your Android application, so they're, you know, bug and crash reporting, all that kind of stuff, and they can also do this on the server as well, and then you can tie that together, so knowing this release X of the Android app and release Y of your Rails API, this perfect storm is happening and you're getting these errors. It's easy to track those things, much easier than it would traditionally be if you didn't have a solution like Rollbar. The cool thing is they also integrate with existing things like Slack, so when I do a deployment or have an issue that comes in, it automatically notifies me inside of a Slack channel, which makes it really easy for me to see what's going on, especially if there's something that's really high priority. I'll know immediately because I'll be getting a bunch of alerts, and it's time to go fix it and check it out. Rollbar is used by a bunch of companies. Kaushik uses them, I use them, but there's also folks like Heroku, Twilio, Kayak, Zendesk, Twitch. The list goes really on and on and on. Now, if you'd like to check out Rollbar, you can go to rollbar.com/fragmented and you'll get the bootstrap plan for free. Again, go ahead and check that out at rollbar.com/fragmented and you'll get that bootstrap plan for free. Thanks for listening and thanks, Rollbar. This week on Fragmented, we talk with Florina from Google about the Room library, which is recently released as part of the Android architecture components. It's a very interesting library, allowing you to work with SQLite in a much easier manner. Perhaps you're tired of writing your queries or your content values and so forth accordingly. Room's going to help you with that and make your life a whole bunch easier. We dive into the topics of creating a database, the entities, the DAOs, also known as the data access objects, how you can interact with them, query them, also observe them with live data, RX Java flowables, and much, much more. We hope you enjoy it. Let's get right to it. Kaushik, welcome back. You just got back from a nice vacation.
I came back from a wonderful vacation. So I was in Peru for some time. And, you know, I think folks would like notice my voice is a little different. That's because I had an amazing time in the last few days. Yeah, it was amazing. I met another Android developer, a good friend of more than one person on the show. His name is June. And if June, hey, you're listening, thank you so much. I had a wonderful time in Lima. So yeah, Peru is amazing, Don. You got to take the kids and the wife and you got to head to Peru. It's amazing.
It's on the bucket list. I think I'll have to try to get there soon enough. But before we can do that, we got someone we have to talk to you today about a very hot topic that's been coming out of Google. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Florina to the show. Florina, I don't want to say your last name because I'm probably really going to mess it up. Could you please let folks know what your full name is, where you work, and kind of what you do?
Sure. Hi. Florina Muntenescu. That's the full name. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Are we talking about Peru? I can also talk about Peru.
Oh, that was like the only reason. That was the only reason we had the show.
But we can also talk about something else that's close to my heart, which is Rome.
Yes.
Yeah.
You ask me who I am, what I'm doing, doing here. So I've been working for the last few months at Google. I'm an Android developer advocate, and architecture components is one of my, let's say, focus points. Before Google, I was working at Upday as an Android developer. Well, I've been working as an Android developer for something like 6 years. Yeah, in Romania first, because I'm Romanian, then in Berlin for something like 4 years, and for the last 3 months in London.
Very nice.
Wow, fantastic. You've kind of been all over the Europe area there. That's cool.
Yeah, and you're very prolific in your blog post writing as well. So you've written like some amazing blog posts, so we'll make sure to add links to all of those in the show notes as well.
Definitely.
I'm so happy to hear this. I really got the chance to check out more some interesting topics. So I try to share my discoveries with the Android community, hopefully to make all of you also as passionate as I am about stuff like ArcJava or architecture components.
You brought up one word right at the very beginning there, and we were intrigued to talk to you about it, and that is Room. That's one of the things that's come out from Google recently. And if for the folks out there that have not had a chance to watch any of the Google I.O. videos, dig into any of the documentation, they've just been hearing this thing about, hey, there's this new thing called Room from, you know, the Android Google team, whatever. What is Room, and maybe why would somebody want to use it?
So if you're developing an Android app and you want to save data in your database, you would use SQLite, more precisely the SQLite database on Android. The problem with that is that it has, you have to write quite a lot of boilerplate code. So, for example, if you want to get the data, you have all sorts of column infos that you need to pass on to get the data. You have to do manually the mapping between the query that that the SQLite gives you to map it to your own objects. Doing testing. Yeah, it's doable. I'm not saying that it's not doable, but it's not easy. And migrations tend to be quite complicated. So the Room is trying to actually help you with all of these. It's actually just an abstraction layer over SQLite that allows you to work with the database easier. And to be honest, I've been avoiding databases for quite a long time.
The untold secret for all Android developers.
Exactly. And a lot of times, whenever I had to modify an existing database, it felt like, you know, I'm there like one of these people that is trying to defuse a bomb. What if I'm touching something and then the database will just, I don't know, explode? And I have to admit, my tests weren't that good, so I wasn't always confident in what I was doing there. When I saw Room, I knew I had to check it out more, and because it pretty much solved a lot of the problems that I had and a lot of the reasons why I avoided working with the database.
A quick follow-up question. So you said, just so that we can give more context to our listeners, you said SQLite, you know, it works on top of SQLite. SQLite is basically baked into Android, right? Like, there's no option whether you get SQLite or not today. Like, you know, if you have an Android device and you're writing an Android developer, if you're writing an app, SQLite is like baked in. It's super efficient. It's well tested. But like you said, the APIs can be, there's a lot to desire with in terms of the APIs, right? But it comes baked in, which I think is like one important thing that we probably should point out.
Yeah. And in the end, Room, all it does is provide a wrapper over it. So it won't really change a lot of things related to how SQLite works internally. It will add some extra things. So, for example, Booleans are not directly supported in SQLite. You always have to do this 0 or 1 conversion. So then Room adds this extra Boolean option for you. But in the end, you're still working with SQLite under the hood. So if you're using, for example, any third-party apps that allow you to see the database on your device, you're still going to use them.
All right. So let's get into the meat of like Room. If someone came to you and said, hey, Florina, like, you know, what are the most important things I need to know about Room? Like, I want to get started right now. So what are the major important things that you think we should like touch on when we get started with Room?
Well, I would say knowing how to create a table, how to query the table. I think these are the basics.
Okay.
So how do you create a table? Maybe we can start with that.
Yeah.
In your mind, you're creating your idea of a table, right? You say you want to have a user. You want to have a user's table. So what you want is every item in the user's table, so every row, sorry, to be an instance of a user object, right? So you would have either a Java class or Kotlin class that represents that data model. With the help of Room, what you can do is just annotate that class with @entity. So this will mean that Room will know that that class is a table in the database. So it will make sure that it will create it whenever needed. Then based on the members that you have inside that class, it will know how to create the table itself, what kind of fields it will have, what kind of columns it will have. You should add annotations like primary key to define which is the primary key in your table. You can define foreign keys also. These would be part of the @entity annotation. And also you can define using the @columninfo annotation, the name of the column. So there's one thing that I really want to mention. I think you should, so that's optional, naming the column. So by default, what Room will do is check what's the name of your field, and then it will use that that name. But then if you're like me and you're still using sometimes the M notation, you don't really want to have your...
This got to end this conversation. Jeez.
Sorry. We got to get out of here.
Okay. So we're stopping this now.
I got to go.
I'm sorry.
We all have our dark secrets.
Let's say that this will be for an older project, right?
Then it's okay.
But definitely you don't want your columns to start with M, right?
Unless you're, you know, working in a certain big company that, like, you know, builds a very big operating system. Just saying.
the column should still not start. Oh. Well, they could start with M, but I wouldn't name them with M. So you would use the column info and the name value to tell the name of the column. So this is really cool because if, let's say, you're using the M notation and you want to remove it, you can just refactor that class without actually changing that column info. So without changing the column name.
So what you're saying is you can, if you fix the column name in the database table by using the column info, then you can keep changing your field. So if you realize that, you know, variables that start with M are like the most horrible thing to do in programming, you could change that to, like, you know, a regular variable and correct your code. But the table doesn't have to change necessarily.
Exactly. So because otherwise, if the table changes, then it means that the schema changes, and this means that you need to provide a migration. So you end up in quite of a big loop there.
One of the things I want to do real quick for the folks that haven't even been exposed to Room whatsoever is I want to kind of rewind for real quick to set some groundwork for how to set up a table. And I know you mentioned you're going to annotate a class, so you have and I just want you to confirm if this is correct or not. So let's say, and I'm coming from a perspective of I've not actually used Room in an application yet, so I'm very still beginner style. If I have a class called user, it has an integer as an ID, and that's a field. It has a first name string, a last name string, and an email string. And those are just the various different things that I would like to persist to Room. So to do that, I got this Java class or Kotlin class. Let's go with Java just because it's easy. At the top of the class, I would annotate, was it entity that I would put at top? Is that correct?
Yeah. And then in the @entity, you can also set the table name.
Okay.
Because maybe you don't want to call it user, you want to call it users,
okay,
or some other name that you want to have for your table. Yeah, you will have to set the primary key, because otherwise, I think Room doesn't know how to use it.
Do I do that primary key at the class level annotation, or am I going to do that actually at the field?
At the field. Yeah. And then one thing that you need to provide is a way for Room to get to the field. So you have to have getters and setters.
Oh, okay.
But setters are not actually mandatory. If you have a constructor that takes all those fields as parameters, that's perfect for Room.
Oh.
But you still need to have the getters.
I have the integer ID too. And one of the things that I've always done in almost every language that I've worked with, anytime I'm working with a SQL type backend, is I'll use some type of auto incrementing feature. Can I do that with Room? Can I tell Room,
yes,
say, hey, this is an auto increment? Oh, I can. How would I do that?
So by default, the auto increment is false.
Okay.
But if you want to enable it in the @primary key annotation, there's a property there that says auto increment. That's a Boolean. And you just set it to true.
Ah, okay.
One thing that's always annoyed me is like multiple primary keys. So I think this is called like composite primary keys. Does Room support that?
Yes. And foreign keys also.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yeah, that's really good to know.
And actually, this leads me to something else, which is having some annotations like at non-null or nullable, because chances are you'll also have to, or you do that in your app. So let's say that you have your user and you know that the email is super important. So you annotate that with non-null.
Okay.
So this will actually be reflected in the structure of the table, because Room will automatically put that constraint on that column. So when it will generate the SQL for the creation of the table, it will say create table users, blah, blah, and then email text not null.
Oh, okay.
Interesting, interesting.
And maybe why it's also important to mention this is, let's say you've developed your application, you've already released one version of your application with Room.
Uh-huh.
And then you realized, hey, actually, I want that email to be non-null, or I want also this other field to be non-null. So this, in the end, it's a schema change, because you're changing the way the table is created. You're putting more constraints on that column.
Right, right. And this is such an important subtle point, right? Because
yeah.
I've played a little with Room. One problem that I ran into, which I didn't realize, was very similar to like what you just said, right? So I've been trying to use like Room with Kotlin directly. And in Kotlin, you know, making it nullable versus non-nullable is basically just adding a question mark at the end, right? It's a matter of just adding one thing. So what basically happened is we had an entity, and like, you know, I think like another well-meaning developer said like, hey, no, this is like not supposed to be nullable. So like, you know, you remove that constraint. So he's like, no, let's make it not nullable. The problem is, like you said, like actually the entity definition has led to a schema change now, which means you need to do a migration.
Exactly.
But like, you know, like he didn't think about that. And like that kind of like you brought in like, so that's a very good gotcha that I think like, you know, we probably should keep an eye out for. So like anytime you're touching the object is like, because like it maps directly to like the entity, like, you know, it looks like an innocent POJO, but really that in some ways is your schema, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It is.
Which brings us, I mean, to kind of the real next point is we've kind of talked about what the, you know, the table structure looks like. We're going to slap the entity annotation on there. We'll do a primary key annotation, maybe not null, whatever. And we've kind of built this model up. And now I have this inside of my application. And I want to store this in SQLite. I need at this point, I'm not really sure how everything wires together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we actually kind of create the wiring to get this set up? How do we access the database and anything like that? What does that look like?
Well, we're missing two things, actually. We never created the database itself. We just mentioned the table.
Okay.
But we haven't related, or we haven't connected that table to any database. And then we have to also access that table. To create the database itself, you have to create an abstract class that extends Room database. So you would annotate that with @database. And there in that annotation, you would set which are the entities in your database. So let's say that you have, you create two entities, user and podcasts. But then if they're in the database annotation, you only put users, you'll only have one table, users, in your database. So you have to really make sure that you put really all of the entities that you want there. So you don't end up with databases without entities.
The entity that you mentioned previously, like say user was like the, you know, the POJO or like the Kotlin, the POCO entity object that we wanted to be created as a table. That has to be defined in the annotation for the database, right? So I have
this
database class. In that, I have a database annotation and I mention the list of tables that I want created.
Exactly.
Oh, so actually, this is more of the starting point, I would imagine, right? Like the database is where, like, you know, Room goes to see, like, okay, I got to start this database process. Let's look at the different things that I have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And also in that @database annotation, you would put the version of your database. So you have also version, let's say 1, or whenever you change the schema, you'll have to increase the version. So that's the number you have to increase. But then this is not enough. You also need to actually build the database. So first of all, you have to make sure that the database is a singleton object, because, well, independent if you're using Vroom or just the normal SQLite database, you should make sure that you're not using multiple instances of the SQLite database in the same time, because you can run into issues.
How do you do that? Yeah.
Yeah. What you need to do is just make sure you're creating a singleton, which in whichever way you usually create singletons in your app. So
got it.
Probably if I'm using Dagger, I would make sure I have an add singleton provider method somewhere in a module. If you're not using Dagger, you just define normal singletons. And then there in the database builder, you'd also define stuff like the database name.
Interesting. And the database name is also specified in that same database annotation? Like, where do we specify that?
No, that would be in the builder.
Okay, in the builder.
Got it. Oh, okay, so the builder is like literally like the builder factory pattern kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's the place where you also define migrations, for example.
Oh, okay, so that's the database file we created, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I don't know if you're curious, but maybe you're curious why this is an abstract class. I was mentioning it's an abstract class.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah. I was saying that it's an abstract class that extends the Room database. Well, because this is the power of Room, it generates things for you. It generates the implementation of this Room database. So mm-hmm. this is the class. Well, if you're really curious, you can check out your app database underscore impulu. Implementation file. Mm-hmm. So what you'll see there is all the queries that Room creates for you to create the tables, and also some invalidation trackers to make sure that your database is up to date and so on. So Room is actually generating everything you would otherwise write yourself if you would be using the SQLite API.
Oh, so that's where all the magic happens. Essentially, you're just like marking these abstract classes. You're almost like defining like an interface to what you want your mm-hmm. database to be.
And exactly.
Then from there, it basically actually just like generates like SQL or whatever like you need for SQL.
Reminds me of auto value kind of stuff.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then we can go to the next part. I think this is pretty much my favorite part when working with the database or when working with Room, mm-hmm. accessing the database that we've just created.
Yeah.
So I have my database. You said I have a database class. I slap the database annotation. In that, I mentioned the different entities. Then I go and create POJOs or POCOs with individual entities. So now I have a database. I have my tables. Great. So I think it's almost like my backend part of the database is set up, but now how do I like access that, right? So I guess like we need something else for that.
Exactly. And I think the access is the key word here because you need data access objects. On short, it's DAO.
Okay.
More precisely, you need to create an interface that you annotate with DAO mm-hmm. That will represent the way you're accessing a specific table. So for example, you would create maybe a DAO for your user. And inside that DAO, you would define the methods that query your database. So these can be like insert, update, delete, or actual queries where you can write your SQL statements.
Interesting. And this has to be an interface or can it also be like an abstract class or something?
It can also be an abstract class. But what's going on under the hood is that actually Room generates that implementation for you. So all of that pain that you would have gone through to actually map the objects, either the input or the output of the queries, mm-hmm. That's something that Room does for you.
So I don't have to write content resolvers and then like cursor keys, all that fun stuff I don't have to write anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. The part that I was always copy-pasting it wrong.
I haven't used Room, like I said, in an application, but I have read the documentation and watched some videos on it. And the one thing about the DAO, the DAO, object that I find very interesting is, like you said, it can be an interface or an abstract class. I would usually roll with interface just because how I'd probably like to do it. But what it really felt like to me is for those of you that have used Retrofit and you define that service interface to go talk to your API and you said, hey, I want to get back a list of users or I want to do something particular, like an insert statement, you have that interface that kind of defines that contract between your local application and wherever the endpoint is. And in this case, the DAO really feels very similar to a Retrofit interface. So I'm basically saying, hey, here's a method called getAll. It doesn't have an implementation. It's an interface, of course. I'm going to, here's the query I need to use. I could have one that says insert. I could have one that says delete. And then as Florina said, it kind of just generates that code for you. So that's where I kind of found that correlation, was like, hey, this feels very much like a retrofit service. So did you feel the same way at all at any point, Kaushik or Florina?
You're totally right. Like that also what like made me feel this is like so retrofit-like, right? Like I can just slap on. And in the end, all that really matters is that interface, right? Like, for example, these days, if you ask me how to do like an actual network connection, I wouldn't know without retrofit, right? Like, you know, I've like completely forgotten. All I care about is I'll just pull up that interface file and it tells me exactly, oh, yeah, that's the network call that's being hit. And in a very similar way, I guess Room is like that, right? Like, I'm like, oh, that's the SQL query that's being done. Like, that's the database call that's being done, right?
I wish you could see me nodding here because I've been nodding for the last minute. It's like, yeah, exactly. DAOs and retrofit are the perfect analogy, I would say.
One quick thing I want to say, though, like the reason I brought up the abstract class is because, and again, this might be like a little no-no territory, so like, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But the reason I found that using an abstract class was like useful for me is because the thing is with abstract classes, you can also have implementations. And I ran into this use case where, I mean, I'm not going to go into the details, but every time I inserted like into the database, I wanted to sort of do a semi-cleanup kind of thing. So I wanted at a maximum only like 20 of these objects to exist, right? The advantage with having an abstract class is like on my insert statement, I can also like add an implementation to say, oh, delete the last, like, you know, X. Like it's almost like a cache maintenance that I could implement in the abstract class itself. Now, people, I know like that might pollute like the interface layer a little and people might like, hey, maybe you should add that somewhere else. Like, yeah, that's true. I know. I get it. But, you know, you can do it if like, you know, it being an abstract class like gives you that advantage. You can add supplemental sort of queries every time you want to, you know, do a specific query. So just throwing that out there.
Maybe where I would see the disadvantage is related to transactions.
Oh.
So by default, everything you put inside a method in a DAO abstract method will be run inside one transaction.
Oh, interesting.
So what happens if, let's say, you want to have a delete all from the database and an insert. And actually, you want this to happen all in one transaction, right?
Right.
Well, you can do that with Room, but what you would need is a reference to the actual database, because the database gives you a running transaction method that allows you to run several DAO queries inside one transaction.
Oh, got it. Like, so in the old days, what would happen is like from the DB, you would get a transaction and then you would say execute SQL or something, right? Like
exactly. And then start transaction, end transaction, and set transaction successful, something like that.
Oh, so you're basically forced to like have all of that done in a single transaction, what you're saying.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that if in your case that where you're clearing, let's say, the database and then inserting something new, if you're putting that method inside the DAO, that by default, if you don't tell it to somehow run it in a transaction, it won't, because it doesn't know that those two query methods that you're calling should be run, both of them inside one transaction.
Oh.
So this should be called from somewhere, from some other class where you have a reference to the database where you can call running transaction.
Got it. Oh, I did not even realize that. Oh, okay. This makes sense now. Okay.
And I think these are extremely important when you're working with observable queries. So when you're actually interested when the database was or when a specific table was modified. Because, for example, if let's say you have a delete from the database and an insert. Let's say that you're observing the table. You have a query that gets all the users, right, from your table. You have a query that returns either a live data object, which is part of the architecture components, or a flowable from RxJava.
Oh, nice.
So let's say that you always want to know what's the latest state of your users table. So this means that every time you will be inserting something in that table, your flowable will emit with a new list. But then if you are doing this delete all users and insert users in two different transactions, it means that you will have your flowable, let's say, that will emit once an empty list corresponding to the deletion of the users, and then another flowable that will emit, another emission for those I don't know, insert users. Whereas if you run all of this in one transaction, so both the deletion and the insert, your flowable will only emit once with the latest data, so with the latest users.
Which is probably what
you... That's nice.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Chances are, I don't know, at least let's say what you could do is have your UI, making sure that your UI displays the latest data in the database. So then if you don't run these in one transaction, you'll end up maybe with some flicker or something if you don't take care of this.
Because it's firing multiple transactions.
Yeah, each one is updates.
Exactly.
Okay, yep. Got it.
So you casually threw something in there.
Yes, I did.
So you just said like, oh, I can add like a flowable or a live data, right? So basically, that's one huge advantage, I guess, to like Realm, right? We've talked to like the folks at Realm, and like we've used Realm, and like one of the biggest advantages I found with Realm was the fact that I can observe queries, right? And I hear these days you can do it with other libraries as well, but it is like a super powerful feature. So could you tell us a little more about that?
So should we stick with the example where you want to get all the users from your database?
Yeah.
Okay. So this means that your DAO can, or your method can return either a list of users or a live data of a list of users or a flowable of a list of users.
Interesting.
So
okay.
If you return just a list of users, that wouldn't be, of course, an observable query. So you'll just get that once and then that's it.
Right.
Whereas if you're using live data or RxJava, you would always get notified of the state of the database, well, of the table, more precisely.
Because you have Rx support, like obviously, then like you know the tendency is to like add Rx for everything, right? And like you know, we talked to Dan Liu in a previous episode, and he said like you know that's also something that we should care about. So, say I have like an insert SQL statement, right? Would it make sense to add like a flowable here? Probably not, right? Like, I mean, maybe that's something that you can control. Like, I'm trying to understand when would I use like a live data or flowable, right? Like, is it mostly just for like when I anticipate something to change with the database? You can insert, you can replace, you can delete. And
that's
like
true.
You know, you can like select, you can do multiple things, but like that doesn't necessarily mean you always want a flowable for those, right?
But only query will return you a live data or a flowable.
Oh,
the insert, for example, is synchronous.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect.
So
okay.
This means it will just return a void or a long.
Oh, perfect. So if I did actually had like an insert query and I added like a flowable, I would get like a compile time error or something.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, fantastic.
Exactly.
Okay, so then I don't have to care. Like, Realm will just take care of me.
What you might want to do is let's say maybe wrap that call inside a completable or single, maybe completable actually, object. So then you can use RxJava to make sure that you're not executing your insert on the main thread. Because if you are doing this, or if you execute any query on the main thread, your app will crash.
Oh.
Because Realm really makes sure that you're not doing things like this, which I am guilty of.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there something wrong? On the main thread, inserting not a good idea?
No.
Okay.
Well, no, because because it can take quite a lot of time, especially if you are trying to insert a big amount of data. And yeah, this, you know, those 16 milliseconds that you only have to draw your UI, that might not be enough for the database. So you might end up dropping frames if you would be doing that on the main thread.
So we've been talking a lot about just getting the query out. We can kind of observe it, maybe perhaps create some type of unidirectional data flow app with these types of, you know, live data flowable type of situations. But that's just for querying. What other types of queries can we work with inside of, you know, inside of this? Can we insert? Can we delete? Or what are our options inside of these data access objects?
Yeah, we also have insert, update, and delete. These don't take as a parameter also an SQL statement. You just annotate your method with @insert, and then in the method, maybe you do insert user or insert users with a user or with a list of users. And then automatically, Realm will insert that user or that list of users for you. and similar for update and delete.
Let me make sure I got this right. So if I create a like void insert and I pass in an instance of a user object and I annotate that method with an insert annotation, Room will automatically generate the correct insert statement and all the plumbing that goes beneath it?
Exactly. And it gives you even more flexibility because you can have some conflict resolution.
Okay.
So let's say that you already have a user with that ID inserted. You can decide what should happen. Should you replace this? Should maybe nothing should happen? So actually what Room is doing here is really, let's say, propagating this power of SQLite to us.
Interesting.
Yeah, because that's something that you could have done it also with SQLite, just, let's say, not so pretty.
So that works for this auto generation and kind of recognition help happens for the insert, delete, and update annotations. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. The one thing that I was wondering if you could touch on that I found very interesting from watching the Google I/O video was actually for the query annotation, where you could provide your own, you know, select statement inside of this query. And if for some reason, let's say I misspell, let's say my users table is just called user, and I misspell or have a typo, which AI do like every 5 minutes, I misspell the table name and then I try to compile. From what I saw online is it looks like Room will actually detect that I've misspelled a column or maybe even the table name. Is my understanding correct, or what does that look like, or how does that work?
Well, not only that it detects it at compile time. So this means that you don't need like run your app to realize that your app is crashing because you named the table wrong, or you don't need to run your test just for this. It will automatically be at compile time. So you'll get a nice error saying that no such column or no such table user, and then you will know where to look.
That's so nice, because then I can't tell you how many times I wrote SQLite code to run the app and then realize I misspelled a column name or forgot the plural version of it or something.
Yes, I am so guilty of it also.
And okay, so the use of the query annotation is interesting, right? So technically, I mean, initially when I saw like insert, update, delete, I thought, oh, there should be a select, right? Because like that's what happens. But it's query, right? So does that technically mean I can execute like any query, any SQL query I want in that?
Yeah, exactly. So let's say that you have your users table and you want to drop only the users that have a specific property. So for example, let's say that you want to drop all the users whose name is Kaushik.
Okay. I'll roll with this. I don't like this example, but let's see. Okay.
So using
drop
the using the add delete annotation, well, you can't really do that because it doesn't allow you to specify any special properties. But what you can do is just use the query annotation, and then inside the SQL statement, you write delete from users where name equals Kaushik, or any other variable that you pass inside the query method.
Oh, that is pretty cool. So this query thing is really powerful.
Yeah.
You get the power of SQL at this point, right? Like you can essentially, like if you can, because when I started my like programming days, I worked like with an Oracle database. And so you can do like some crazy queries, right? Like joins, like you can do like left join,
exactly.
Right join, like, you know, intersection, non-intersection. So all of that works now. I can basically, if I can come up with like a sufficiently complex SQL query that does what I want, I can just like plug it into that query annotation and it'll all just work.
I know that FTS, so file text search, I think, that doesn't work. That's not supported.
Got it. Okay,
but
okay.
I would say most of the crazy queries that you might be using might work. Chances are they will work. And if they don't, double check your SQL query statement, whether it's correct or not.
Yeah, that's super powerful. So technically, I could just use query annotations and not use anything else and I can be fine, right?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, it makes sense to use like the power, because there are other checks that come with like the other ones, like insert and like delete and update, like you mentioned. Okay. That makes sense.
We've been talking a lot about just individual, you know, just a user class. But in real world applications, we have a bunch of domain models and we have a bunch of relationships that are between these different models. Does Room support relationships, or how do we work with situations when we need to have certain data objects either related to it, or maybe even various different objects inside of an entity? So a user may have an address object or something like that. Is that going to be a relationship, or is there another way we can handle that? Or does Room even account for those situations at all?
A lot of questions there, and I have a lot of answers for you.
always asking the real questions here.
Let's start with a simple one. Let's say that the user has an address. So let's consider that address is unique. So you can't have multiple users having the same address. So this means that you want actually the address to be just some fields inside the user table.
Okay.
So let's say that you would just have a street, a city, and a country that are all three grouped inside an address object. Well, all you need to do with Room is to put that address object inside your entity and say that it's embedded. So automatically the table that will be generated will contain your users' columns, your users' members, but mm-hmm. also the ones from the address.
So it actually flattens it out almost.
Exactly, yeah.
And embedded is like an annotation, right? It's a special Room annotation that you add in.
Yes. So that's one thing. But if you have a one-to-many relation, so let's say that you can have multiple users living at the same address, and you would like to have another table for that address where every address has its own ID. Well, that becomes a one-to-many relation, right? Because you have one address and multiple users that use it. So here, probably you will want to use maybe some foreign keys. So for example, inside the user table, you'll want to have a foreign key to the ID of an address. That's just the normal database mm-hmm. magic.
Right. Like that's like the normalization principles on the database, right?
Exactly.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
So we had our example with a user that had an address. So let's say that we want to get all the users that live at a specific address. So this would mean that you would have something like a data object that can be either Java or Kotlin that's called something like address with users. So there you would have your address, and then you would have a list of users, right, that live there. Mm-hmm. So all you need to do is annotate that list with at relationship. So automatically in Room, when you query the address and you return that address with users, Room will know that you actually are interested not only in the address, but also in the users corresponding to that address.
Oh.
So it will automatically give you all those users. This is actually all based on the power of SQLite, because these foreign key constraints and so on are not... let's say any dark magic coming from Room, but actually it's based on SQLite's dark magic.
From this point forward, we've built our entities, we've built our database, we've got everything set up, we've created the database, we're now talking about how we've got data in there, we're modifying it, we're observing it, the application's doing what it's supposed to be doing. I get a new feature request from one of the product owners, and they say, hey, we need to add these four additional fields to the user entity. Now, how do I go about implementing that type of thing in Room?
Well, so first of all, it means that you need to change your entities, right? Mm-hmm. To add those new four fields to your user. So that's the first step. But then this means that your database schema has changed. So your database doesn't look as before. So this means you need to increase your database version. So let's say from 1, you have to go to 2, or from 10, you have to go to 11. And then you have to tell Room how to handle that. You have to tell Room what changed. So you could do this by implementing a migration from, let's say, version 1 to version 2. And there you would say, you would actually tell Room what changed. So you would do something like modify the table and then add those other four columns to your user's table. But this is not mandatory. So, for example, if you don't care about the user's data, so let's say that you don't care about the existing users of your application and whether they lose your database data or not, you don't really need to provide that migration. If you set another flag inside the database builder. So that's fallback to the destructive migrations.
Oh.
So this means that whenever your database has changed, Room won't care what changed and it will just drop your tables and then recreate them. But if you really care about the user's data, then I strongly recommend implementing a migration.
I like how like you're subtly playing like, you know, like the police flag saying like, well, if you really don't care about your users, then you can use this. But so basically, you're indirectly telling us to write our migrations is what I'm sensing. But but yeah. Right.
Also, to be honest, I think I would have avoided it before, especially because of the testing, because it's it wasn't so easy to test migrations.
So what have you done for that?
Yeah, with Room is actually pretty easy. With Room is pretty easy to test pretty much everything you've implemented related to Room. So for migrations, for example, there is a test rule. I think it's called migration test helpers, something like that. And this allows you to create a database in a specific version, then trigger the migration with a list of migrations, and then see if everything went well. So let's say that you're right now in database version 10. And then in version 11, this is where you've updated your users table. So what you can do is with the help of Room to just see whether if someone starts your application with database version 1, and then migrates it to 11. What happens? What if they start in version 2, migrates it to 11, and so on? Yeah, it's quite easy to test. What Room won't be able to test for you, so it will only check the schema, but it won't check really the data integrity. So let's say that maybe you're also setting some default values for those fields, right? So what you will need to do in this case is create a database in a specific version, insert some data, then trigger the migration, let Room do the validation for you, and then also query the database to check whether indeed your data is there and it has the correct value or the value that you expect.
So there was one thing that while listening to the talks on Room that you've been giving, there's also certain cases where I can say, actually, you know, if you're migrating from version, 3 to 11, then, you know, instead follow this migration path. Like, I don't have to, like, for example, and like where I think this might be useful is like, say I have like I have a long-standing app and like, you know, I have like, let's say 50 migration, like I'm at version number 50. That means every single time I've moved from like version 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6, mm-hmm. etc., I've had to have written a migration for that, right?
Yeah.
But you can say if you're at version 3 and you want to go to 50, instead, like, you know, follow this migration path, right? Like, that's also something that's there. So when is that like a benefit? Like, you know, is it like usually in the cases where like you have like 100 migrations and you don't want to necessarily like go through every single thing? Is that like the idea?
I think to understand where the benefit is you have to know when the database is created and when the migrations are actually triggered. So the actual database is created the first time you're accessing the database. So not when you're starting your application.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So let's say that you're only querying the database when you're going to some other screen, not your main screen. So this means that exactly that is the moment when your database is created. So that's also the moment when the database checks whether it needs to trigger migrations.
Hmm.
If it does need to trigger migrations, if you have a long list of migrations, it means that it will have to go through each of them step by step. And that can take time depending on how many migrations you have and what you're doing in those migrations. So this means that if you provide a migration from version 3 to version 50, Room will check, okay, what's my shortest path to get to this latest version? And it will use that. So instead of triggering, let's say, 50 migration, it will only trigger one or two. depending on which version you're starting from.
Oh, so that's why it's important to like actually make sure that you're at the shortest, you have the shortest migration strategy, because yeah, it could happen at any point of time, right?
Yeah, it's not mandatory, and I think it also depends on your application. I think we as developers tend to know how people are using our app, and then we get to see that, hey, actually, nobody's using our app that's under version 40 of our database. So maybe in that case, you won't implement migration from version 1 to version 50. But where it's needed, you might.
So rounding up the migration things, right? Like, you wrote this fantastic blog post, which actually is what I've been using. Like, you know, every time I have like doubt, I'm like, oh, there's something interesting. Because migrations, like even with Room, like, I mean, it is like you have to care about it, right? And migrations basically means it's looking back at the history of how your application, like database, has evolved. So it's not like, I mean, it's easy to say like you can test migrations, but they still exist, right? And migrations are tricky, like in the nature of like how, like what they do. So
exactly. I think they're pretty powerful, and that's what makes them tricky.
Right. All right, Florina, thank you so much. This has been amazing. We kept shooting a lot of questions, and this is like a lot of interesting things. It's so nice to see that like Room exists as part of like Android architecture mm-hmm. components now that we can use it. What are some resources that you think like we should start? Because like Room is relatively new. Are there any specific resources that like you can point us to that you think like we should be looking at as we get acquainted with Room?
I would say definitely the samples that we have out there on Google samples / Android architecture components. We have like 5 of them that cover stuff from migrations to content providers to Rx Java. And did I mention Kotlin? Kotlin also.
Nice.
Also a bigger extensive example that uses Dagger. So I would say in terms of code, check those out. On our Google Developers Medium page, we've published a few articles about it, about Room, and a few others also about the other architecture components. So I definitely recommend checking out the ones about view models, just saying. Yeah, I would say these two are the main, plus the normal documentation, normal developer androids.com.
Very cool. And I also want to make sure I throw this in. I had the pleasure of meeting both Florina and Eat at 360 and Dev. And both of them gave fantastic talks. Like, those were like one of my favorite talks. I hope both of them are out by now. So I'll make sure like we'll add links to that as well. Both of those talks were just like fantastic job. Like, you're so happy to see like, you know, Google is like doing such a great job now with sharing a lot of like these resources and like knowledge. So we'll definitely add links to those as well.
Thank you. We're also trying to keep at least the articles and the documentation, of course, up to date, because some things already changed, luckily, from the 360 and Dev talk.
Oh, interesting.
But I definitely recommend it. Like 95% of it is still there. It's still valid. Go check it out. Extra, we have this more Kotlin and Rx Java support. So the maybe and the single, but the rest is definitely valid.
Perfect. And like, in fact, I remember even like Eat's talk, like, you know, he talked about like the process that you folks went through when you built the library, right? Like, mm-hmm. oh, like why you took certain decisions, why you didn't take certain decisions. So a lot of that was very interesting. You know, it just helps you understand the library better. So thank you both for that. Yeah.
Thank you. The architecture components in general was developed for the community, with the community. So we hope that we can continue working together on this.
Absolutely. And we are super, super excited mm-hmm. to help with the same. But Florina, if usually folks have questions, what's like a good way on the internet that like, you know, they can reach out to you, because you write like fantastic blog posts. Like, you've actually written like some great blog posts on like public speaking as well. So like, what's a good way to like find out like the different stuff that you've been up to?
Thank you. I would say easiest would be Twitter. So you can find me at F. Montanescu. I do hope you put that in the show notes, because otherwise it's going to be harder to get. Or for any questions specific to any blog post, just add a comment there in the section and I'll answer it.
And Don, once you've gotten into a room and... Oh, I'm going to stop at the point. Don's slow clapping there. Like, oh, what's the best way to reach you, Don?
The best way to get a hold of me is going to be on Twitter, and that's going to be at Don Felker. Kaushik, when folks want to get a hold of you and chat about all of the things that you've done with this wonderful library, how can they get a hold of you?
I am Kaushik Gopal on Twitter. So folks, again, Twitter, feel free to reach out on Twitter. All right, folks, thank you all for listening. If you have suggestion topics or like, you know, if you have comments, then contact@fragmentedpodcast.com is our email address. If, you know, email is your thing. Otherwise, feel free to reach out to any of us through Twitter. Florina, thank you so, so much for coming on today. This has been super enjoyable. And like, I'm pretty sure we can go on for another hour, but I hear like, you know, you have work to do on Room and like at Google. So we're going to let you go now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Florina.
This episode of Fragmented has been brought to you by Rollbar. Rollbar is used by a bunch of companies. Kaushik uses them, I use them, but there's also folks like Heroku, Twilio, Kayak, Zendesk, Twitch. The list goes really on and on and on. If you'd like to check out Rollbar, you can go to rollbar.com/fragmented and you'll get the bootstrap plan for free. Again, go ahead and check that out at rollbar.com/fragmented and you'll get that bootstrap plan for free. Thanks for listening and thanks, Rollbar.
That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.